Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. S&P Futures up 5. NASDAQ Futures up 40. Bunch of earnings last night. We have Google up $11. That's 6%. We have Caterpillar taking the Dow down 15.5. That's 4%. What else we got in the Dow? We got Amgen down 6. We got Amazon up 4. So some stuff moving on earnings. Seems like the stuff is continuing to move more, at least as much as the straddle, and sometimes way more, which I'm not so sure what that tells the world, but generally the market's pretty good at predicting the move, and there's been some really outlier moves in the last 6 to 9 to 12 months, which is somewhat interesting. I understand we have Kevin and we have Mr. Mike Murphy. How are you guys?
Oh, good morning. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you guys?
We're doing good.
All right.
We're doing good considering, you know.
I am day-to-day.
Yeah, we are like the rest of us, day-to-day. Anyway, hey, Kevin, you know what we didn't do? We can take a few minutes. We never did a little thing about Fernando Valenzuela. I'm sure Mike would like to be part of that as well. Quite a story, huh?
Fernando was amazing. A 20-year-old?
Yeah.
Unknown, you know, signed out of Mexico, came out, won Rookie of the Year Cy Young, and touched off a phenomenon known as Fernando Mania in Los Angeles. And he was a very good pitcher for not a really long career, but for a pretty good, you know, a pretty good length career.
Well, he threw a screwball, which is incredibly difficult to throw on your arm and so forth. Might have been one of the reasons why the career wasn't that long. I don't know that. But he came, big guy, when I, you know, not that I ever faced anybody who threw a screwball, but it's something you don't normally see. I mean, matter of fact, very rarely. Don't you have to come way over the top with it, Kevin? You have to have huge
hands.
Yeah,
it's sort of like what you're doing is you're throwing a curveball in reverse.
Yep.
Is probably the easiest way to describe it. And that's just, it is. It's very stressful on the arm.
It's sort of the equivalent of a backup ball in bowling. It's totally unnatural. It's kind of easy to, matter of fact, my buddy Dr. J, the world's worst bowler, but great athlete. He throws a backup ball. And I go, John, how the hell do you throw a backup ball? And he goes, what do you mean? I said, do me a favor, will you scratch your ear? He goes, I'll just scratch your ear. I said, you come up with your palm toward your head if you scratch your ear, right? It's a very natural move. Backup ball is exactly the opposite. Well, screwball is the opposite. But I saw him pitch. Get a load of this. Talk about a crazy story. First time he came to Chicago, Don and I had we split the tickets, but that just happened to be his day. So he had the good seats. And I got some in the grandstand. Everybody knows how the grandstand is. It's now what? Terrace Reserved is the grandstand? Is that what they call it?
Whatever they can do to put a high price on it.
Yeah. So we get our seats in the grandstand, and we're sort of near the back. But, you know, they weren't horrible. And all of a sudden, these two dudes come in. They're setting up shop behind me with a big horn and a car battery. They somehow... How do you think you got the car battery through the metal detector? Anyway, or the horn.
We didn't have metal.
No, we didn't have any of that stuff. So what do you suppose... Here's a question for Mike, being the military dude. What do you suppose the first thing I did since I had parked like two blocks away?
Who knows, Tom?
I checked.
You checked your battery when you got back.
No, I checked the brand of the battery.
Oh, okay.
I saw it was a Sears 48 month, and I had a diehard, so I felt, okay, at least it's not me. How awful is that? But he was he pitched. I don't know who won, but when he started pitching, Ryne Sandberger was up, and a couple pitches that Rhino just, like, he never even saw that before. He turned around and he asked the umpire, was that a strike? He had never seen one break like that before. I mean, he was really something.
Yeah, he was. He was a terrific pitcher.
And then he ended up being the Spanish language guy for the Dodgers for a year, and then he became the
broadcasting. Yeah.
And then he became the regular went on the regular radio, right?
Well, the other thing I loved about him is he's another one of those guys that looks nothing like an athlete. Thick through the middle. Not very tall, not very big, and we'll have to sometime when we're just kicking around. There's nothing going on. We'll have to put together an all fat guys team.
Wilbur Wood,
Louis Tiant would be another one. He and Valenzuela kind of looked alike, actually.
Yeah.
The build was the same.
Well, most of the stuff, if you read on Quora, when they talk about pitchers deserving of the Hall of Fame that aren't in there, the name that constantly comes up is Rick Rushel. And there's a guy, it didn't look like he was your basic plowboy, but the dude used to use him for a pinch runner. And doesn't he still have the highest batting average?
I've never heard him mentioned as a Hall of Fame candidate.
Hey, but you know what? His big, when they talk about the war, he's right up there. He's like one of the highest wars of people that aren't in the Hall of Fame.
Okay, I'll believe you.
Because he had a huge career after he left the Cubs.
Maybe that was the problem. He's been on the Cubs.
Well, so. You know what the problem was, Mike? He was a star for the Cubs for a long time on really horrible teams. And then he had this, did he have shoulder surgery, I think it was. And he comes back, and he was on the Cubs, and he used to throw like a simulated game every 5 days or something. And I'm reading the paper, like the newspaper guy going, geez, you know, every time the guy throws, he's up like a mile an hour or a mile and a half an hour. He's really coming back. And he actually, the Cubs had a couple guys hurt the first time they were ever in the playoffs. And a couple guys hurt, and then he actually came in at the end of the year and had to pitch, and he won like three games for them right when they needed him. Then they kept him off the playoff roster for some reason. And the next year, I think they traded him to San Francisco. And San Francisco knew he was getting better. Was he an all-star the next year, Kevin?
I'll take your word for it. I don't remember.
I was kind of a fan of his because one of my buddies went to Western Illinois, and he was a big star at Western Illinois. He was their best hitter, too. Anyway, but he was talking about the all-fat guy team. I mean, he did not look like a player.
Nope. He looked like a farm boy. You could imagine him out there baling some hay.
Oh, God, yeah. So, Mike, we have not, with all the crazy stuff going on here in the politics, we have not even talked about the various wars going on around the world. Is there any, what is this last week? Bits and pieces between the politics. They're sending North Koreans to fight for the Russians? What is that all about? Have you heard that?
Well, North Korea and Russia have always had a state/client relationship. And now the North Koreans are paying the Russians back, I would imagine. Plus, the North Koreans need some experience, too. So this is a good way for them to get that.
Well, what about the guys that don't come back? Are they experienced?
Yeah, I guess they are experienced but dead. So,
well, they claim that they're going to be in training for a while. I thought Lou keeps talking about the Russian guys. They drag them out of jail, give them a uniform, and shove them in the front. There's no training.
Well, I doubt there's very much training. And the North Koreans, their elite forces are supposed to be good. They may be a little bit underfed, but I think that applies more to their regular army people. So their elite forces are probably, you know, a relatively adequate fighting force. So,
Mike, I'm not going to ask any questions that you can't talk about, but I know when you were in the Army, you did a lot of intelligence stuff. How exactly, you know, in 30 words or less, which is impossible, how does a country like North Korea, where they claim if you fly near the place, you see half the people don't even have lights at night and so forth, and nobody's... How do they manage to have factories and stuff to produce these weapons that aren't all bad, and manage to put stuff, you know, rockets together? Are they just buying that stuff from people? I don't see how they'd have the infrastructure to put together, you know, from scratch, rocket engines and stuff. How many parts do you think are in one of those things? A million?
Well, I think that the Chinese are probably helping them some, and the Russians are helping them some. But they've always had the ability to manufacture their own stuff. So, and you know, they repress their population. So it's just like most totalitarian societies. You know, that the people are oppressed, and the money goes to the military and the elites.
Well, I mean, I always have this question, because having worked at a place that made railroad cars, you know, reasonably complicated pieces of machinery, but certainly not like a rocket or anything like that. There's 20,000 parts in a railroad car. There's no way Pullman could make all of those parts, and we're in America, and the power's on all night. I mean, how does somebody make a rocket when you can't make a stove for somebody? I mean, it's the amount of pieces that go in there is just, unless you've actually seen it and done it, you have no idea how many different nuts and bolts, how many different this, how many buttons, how many electrical. I mean, how do you even go about doing it in a country where nobody can even drive around the place? It just seems weird to me.
Well, I just think it's the priority of the society, Tom, or the government, excuse me, is to, you know, build military weapons so that they find whatever they need to do it. Well, I know that's rather simplistic, but it becomes
an incredibly high percentage of their economy.
Right.
So they're not making stoves, and they're not, you know, there's all kinds of things they're not making because they're making rockets.
Well, I mean, here, if you want, I want to say in that thing is 200 different kinds of fasteners. We can open up a catalog here. Where the hell do they get them? I mean, they must be getting them from Russia or China. Even those guys, their distribution system is pretty horrible.
Yeah, but China's huge. They can make all kinds of stuff and still...
But you know better than any of us.
Still not be doing well.
But you know better than any of us. Getting the part, the person, or the tool to make it in one spot is pretty tough anywhere. It seems like it's, you know, I mean, it's like doing something in Gaza. How the hell do you put something together there, for God's sake? I mean, but people do it. You're right. They do it somehow.
Well, that was the priority of Hamas, too, was building those tunnels and then putting rock, you know, well, kind of lousy rockets, but putting very fundamental rockets together. That's what they've done for years. And Hezbollah is the same thing. And now they all had help from the Iranians, but they were just getting the parts probably from the Iranians, or, well, I know that they get more than parts, but even so, the priority for Hamas was, you know, building their infrastructure.
Well, Mike,
and that's why it's taken the Israelis so long to, you know, knock them out.
Well, Mike, what's the difference? You know, I'm not expecting to be a weapons engineer, but, you know, something like a Scud, where you just aim it in that direction and shoot the damn thing, or something that actually can guide itself. The difference in technology has to be night and day, isn't it?
Right. That's why the Hamas and Hezbollah just made simple Scud missiles. They you know, their stuff isn't all that sophisticated. So,
you should see now when in the Iran, the war with Iraq, when I was in the OEX pit, how much the guys used to mimic and kid about the Scuds. Somebody put up a poster of a Scud coming to one of the guys in the pit. They don't like hitting them in the head. Scuds were kind of a joke, but I guess they're not the joke if they land on you, huh?
No, that's right. And you know, there were plenty of Scuds in Saudi Arabia the first time. Every time those damn alarms went off, you know, we had to kind of scurry to bunkers or whatever.
That must be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the old war. You hear the Japanese planes would be running them in the South Pacific.
Well,
right?
Can you imagine in Ukraine right now? You know, I mean, every night they're getting bombed. So, you know, the Russians are just laying it on them, and they'll do that all winter, I think. Now that they probably have some supplies and, you know, and the oil business is going well for them, so they got plenty of money coming in. So who knows?
Did you check that thing out that I sent from Shanny? They're talking about all the different old oil tankers scurrying around over in the South China Sea, kind of on their way to North Korea, and they're transferring cargo to try and hide where they got the oil from and all that stuff. And two of them banged into each other. Did you get a chance to read that?
No, I did not.
It was kind of a, how would you describe it, Kevin? It's like a circus over there where these oil tankers like circling around, waiting for a higher price, which they don't seem to be getting because oil's been going down. And all of a sudden, I can't imagine. And so, it's so hard for the military to do it. Those idiots being able to do an oil to oil transfer, and they better have a calm ocean, don't you think? I mean, so they're putting stuff from oil to oil from an Iranian old junk into something else that people think is from another place. So when it lands in North Korea, they have their transponders off. We can't trace it, or they think we can't. Then they would. They come home with rackets on the damn thing, or what?
Well, they can do that, yeah. And, you know, that's how they've been doing this stuff for years, so that's how they hide the weapons.
Unless you can board the vessel, they can say they have whatever they want, and they can really have whatever they want.
Well, I guess if you turn a transponder off, I suppose we still catch them on satellite in the daytime, right? You could probably get the heat plume at night, can't you, Mike? I would imagine.
Well, you can catch them with satellite any time of day, you know, and that's... The Israelis have tried that with the Palestinians. One time had a Turkish flagged vessel, and the Israelis stopped it, and then the Turks got all upset, but they gradually settled it out. But that caused a lot of consternation. This was 15 years ago, and the Turks were very upset that the Israelis boarded one of their vessels, but Israelis, and then the Israelis had the evidence. They found missiles or whatever weapons, so that, you know, they were right in doing what they did.
When they talk about a flagged vessel, if you can, why don't you explain that a little bit? Isn't it a long time? Is it like most is probably the wrong word. Weren't there a million vessels that were flagged in, like, Libya or someplace? What was the connection between
Libya and Liberia were the two biggest violators.
But what do they get out of it? And if you board one of their vessels, it's not really even theirs. How do they have the nerve to say anything?
Well, I don't think the Liberians would have cared. The Libyans might have cared. But they're just getting a cut of something, whatever it is, whether it was oil or... You know, it all comes down to, I think it comes down to the money, just as you would probably say.
Well, can you just go buzzing around the world in a ship that's not insured? Or?
Yes, I think you can. But I'm not all that familiar with Navy procedures. But, you know, the Libyans did it for years. Some African countries do it. So, Tom, I'm not sure.
You know more than me.
That the Somalis were hitting in the Indian Ocean, you know, that was probably, you know, somebody else's flag, getting raided.
So you and I and Kevin go out and buy or have built some big old freighter, and what do? We call up Libby and say, hey, how about flagging us, even though I don't know any of you guys? I
mean, there's probably some application procedure, And some of these nations have very easy, application procedures. I think the Vietnamese did it at one time, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, you'd also put it under the shell, kind of a shell ownership of a company there, whether you set it up yourself or whether you just use, an existing company there. You just say this is the owner, and so go ahead, you know, have at it.
I bet there's a law firm or two in Liberia that specialized just in this.
No, you're probably right.
Yeah. How much stuff do we say belongs in to the Caymans?
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Well, Mike, what's going on in the Red Sea? I guess my theme this morning, with one of the reasons why I wanted you, I must want to talk a little bit about sports, but are the wars tied down, or they just can't get on the front page with all the politics, I guess, is the thing.
They're just not getting on the front page. You know, there was an article, I don't know whether it's this past weekend or maybe a little bit before that, you know, the Russians were helping the Houthis target ships in the Red Sea. So, you know, the Russians, this whether it's an access of evil or not, you know, the Russians, the Houthis, the North Koreans, the Iranians, it's really the Russians, the Iranians are, you know, sponsoring, whether it's terror or war fighting capabilities in the Middle East. That they want the conflict to continue.
Well, we talk
because it keeps diverting us, Tom. That's really why
it does.
It's chaos. That's chaos. They want chaos, and they're getting chaos.
Right.
That's what I think is. I wish, regardless of who lands where, I wish the American people would. I'm not saying they should know as much as you, Mike. They're not going to, but at least have some kind of interest in what we're talking about. Because I'm asking you because you know, and I don't. But at least you know I have the curiosity to know that this stuff going on, and we're spending money in all these places, and it could get a lot worse. We don't have any. I mean, this stuff ties into what we're doing here domestically.
Well, Tom, you and I aren't living paycheck to paycheck. You know, there's a lot of Americans right now, and even before that, they're living paycheck to paycheck, and they would like to see us isolated. They would rather see us isolated. And I think some of that is the appeal of Trump, an isolationist policy, America First policy. So that's one aspect of it. And they see us wasting money in like Ukraine. Well, I don't particularly see that as a waste of money. We've got to stop the Russians somewhere.
Yep.
But it's just a matter of, okay, how much are we going to give to it? So.
Well, and is it going to be well used?
Well, that's right, Kevin. And we've been supporting the, Ukrainian government agencies. We're paying salaries of people. And that's why guys like Tom Cotton and some other people, they're rightfully upset about that. Our money could go to military weapons, but instead it's going to the Ukrainian corrupt bureaucracy. And Ukraine's been corrupt since, the wall fell. And it's just a matter of how corrupt it is. So.
Well, I mean,
I still have a question about how much of the Biden administration's foreign policy is shaped by the fact that he is compromised and that the people in Ukraine know damn well what they have on him.
Well, I agree with you. And, obviously his son and Joe probably got a lot of kickback. So it's just a matter of proving that. And they haven't proved it. Well, they have proved it to some degree, but that Jamie Comer guy, he just keeps yakking away. They never bring anything to fruition. So in that respect, I have little regard for Comer and Jim Jordan and those guys that keep saying that there's something there, but they never prove what the something is.
Well, they're looking for the cash trail, but when I look at it, we know what got to Hunter. We also have Hunter on the record, bitching about how much of his father's bills he has to pay. You don't have to transfer cash.
That's true. That's very true.
You want to launder it, just do it that way.
Well, there's part of the corruption trail and part of the money trail. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, the Russians, obviously, North Koreans seem like they want to as well. They don't want places that are developed okay, where you can't go in. How much are they paying these poor Houthi guys to risk their life to run out there and shoot against destroyers, for God's sake?
I doubt that they're paying them much, Tom. For the Houthis, it's a battle. It's for them, it's survival. They don't want the Israelis in the Middle East, so it's all about getting rid of the Israelis.
But I mean,
and the U.S. We're the
for
great
them, it's their holy war.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, you're talking about people that don't have a pot to piss in and are being led around by religion. I mean,
that's been happening for years.
Well, we had a St. Bernadette's, which is now one came down. Believe it or not, they tore my parish down. How bad is that? But the we had a,
did you do to them?
Yeah, no kidding. The Quonset, we used to play ball in, down.
Yeah.
Anyway, going to church on Sunday was always a family thing, and the guy would read something from the gospel, and then he'd have a, mind your mother and father kind of homily, right? Well, somehow or another, St. Bernard had some guy in there, that was going to grad school somewhere, and he was just helping him out. So he comes in and he gives one of these homilies like they would do at Notre Dame, you know, where the guy worked on it all week. You know, it's like a serious piece of literature. The guy starts talking about more economic wars were fought in the name of religion than for any other reason. The people there are like horrified.
Well, it's still true.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but I mean, I guess what I'm saying, how bad is life in Hootie Land?
It's pretty bad. Yemen is a cesspool.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, one group, somebody somewhere, seems to want to help these people out and get sanitation and stuff, and somebody else wants them poor as church mice so they can hire them for $5 a day to go kill themselves. Right?
I mean, you also want them poor so that they are feeling oppressed. And as long as you can convince them the enemy is who you want the enemy to be.
The old playbook, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a pretty standard playbook.
And we've got the same playbook going on here now, you know, the oppressed versus the oppressor. So,
well, you have everybody that's the thing that I find really frightening, and I don't think this is one side or the other, the amount of people that somewhat are on the dole pissed off that other people are on the dole. Because they think they're going to get less. I mean, it's like, guys. I mean, I wish. I mean, I don't wish you guys were here. And you watch what's happening in Chicago, not just to the city itself. Because when you see the amount of money and manufacturing places, I mean, you look at the footprint 40 years ago, and you look at it now, and who's here and who's paying taxes. It's not even remotely close. I mean, even if you had Harry Houdini as a mayor, he's faced with a shrinking tax base in some kind of way. They got to get it going. I mean, if Pritzker, out of the blue, can pull this thing off, I've said this a few times, down at Southworks, I don't know how the hell he did that. If he actually gets, like, 1,000 employees down there doing high-tech stuff, boy, oh, boy, he must have talked to these guys. I don't know what he promised them, but
well, he's going to have to probably finance the whole thing. So
I mean, it's that area. The ground's horrible. The schools are damn near closed. The housing stock hasn't had a new roof on it in 40 years. I mean, it's the land of time forgot. Obviously,
well, how many people has Illinois lost in the last 5-10 years?
Well, Chicago's lost 300,000 or something.
Yeah,
but it's
I wonder how the state's doing.
Yeah, Chicago's turning into Detroit. It's if you backed up 15 to 20 years, Chicago is what Detroit. Chicago now is what Detroit looked like then.
Getting close.
Detroit's down to what, like 500,000 people, something like that.
But you wonder. I don't know,
Detroit is also, in a turnaround, but they had to hit rock bottom before they could start to turn things around.
I'm not so sure how much of the turnaround. I got some, but
yeah, I'm not saying it's charging back. It's stabilized. There is some development going on there. Will they be able to attract businesses? I don't know. The point is that Detroit is not. It's way better than it was if you were to back up even 5 years.
Well, I think you need somehow or another the way everybody's going about the welfare and the helping and all the other kind of stuff is really all wrong. And I don't know, I mean, it's not up to me to, but I think if the three of us got in a room and, had a blackboard, I'll show my age, whatever we do, everything that is considered helpful is too expensive if we don't do it. Yet in the long run, I'm not so sure that it isn't cheaper than just status quo. I mean, it's I go by this morning, I pick Andrew up, and every Wednesday I'm astounded. There's like six people just standing, essentially in my neighborhood at DePaul, in security outfits, and these are able-bodied people just standing there. I don't think they're armed, basically talking to each other. What the hell are they doing? These are six people that could have like, well, it is a real job. They're showing up. They're doing what they're supposed to do. I'm not bitching at anybody individually, but for God's sake. What a waste of humanity. I mean, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, and if it does, the guys that do it should be put in jail for 10 years so they don't do it again. I mean, we seem to have lost all track of what is right and wrong on this stuff. Or is it just me being grumpy?
Well, you're grumpy, but I think you're right in this case.
Yeah, I mean, what do you... There's guy you walk through the Board of Trade at night. There's like 5 security guards standing there, just standing there. There's nobody in the building. The place is half empty. You've passed 5 people saying hello to you. What kind of job is that to stand there for 8 hours and at age 30 and do nothing and talk to anybody? What a waste of a day for a human being.
Well, unfortunately, that's what a security job is like.
Right, but I'm saying these are buildings that used to have like one person. Now they got 8. And they used to have 3,000 people in the building. Now they got 500. We're going the wrong way here.
Well, that might be some sort of a patronage system job. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's essentially what the Navy's doing in the Red Sea. All they're doing is patrolling. They're just targets. And that's not a good thing. Although, in some respects, we're fighting back. But we could be doing a heck of a lot more there if the government would unleash them. So
yeah, I mean, what if you were to design? We talk about this, Mike, quite a bit. If we were to design ships and even planes to deal with this kind of wacky threat in places like that, how much different would our stuff look?
I don't think it would look much different. I mean, the Red Sea's a big place, and maybe we'd have some smaller, more riverine craft to handle like a place like Vietnam or small islands or something like that. But for the most part, well, the Navy keeps getting cut too. Most of the forces keep getting cut.
Yeah, it's a problem.
I think that the Navy guys have, developed packages that can be used in different places. So.
Well, it seems like if we had a nice little submarine that every time these guys left the dock, submarine popped up with a 5-inch gun, I think that'd be a problem for them, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it would. But, submarines are high maintenance.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Every submarine now has to be 3 blocks long with 12 ICMs in the thing. I mean, right? I mean, we don't... It seems, we talked to Lou a lot about, do we have enough supply ships? I mean, are we up and down the chain ready for, like you said earlier? I mean, I think very, very intelligent.
No, we are not ready at this point. We used to have a deal, and this is when I was in the service, not in the service, but still working for the Army. We were capable of fighting 2 wars at the same time, and then the Pentagon said, okay, you only need to fight 1 war. And now I bet you they're hardly capable of fighting the 1 war.
Well,
and now we're shipping.
We're capable of an orderly exit from Afghanistan. So,
right.
Well,
that was the leadership too. But who knows?
Well, they made some mistakes. But has there ever been an organized retreat? Vietnam didn't look so hot either. Matter of fact, it looked awful.
You didn't have. It wasn't as drastic as the pullout from Afghanistan. They made a mistake when they said don't leave troops there. They should have left like 5,500 troops and kept the Kabul or the Bagram airport.
Yep.
They didn't. That was the biggest mistake. They didn't keep the Bagram airport. So.
Yeah, I'm not so sure why, but I mean,
Biden had a thing where he said you could keep no more than 2,500 troops. So that was the limitation. That was the major planning factor that screwed everything up.
Well, Obama said he was going to do it. Trump said he was going to do it, and Biden finally did it. Do you think the other 2 guys would have made it look any better?
Yes. Yes, they had a different plan.
But they didn't.
Yes, they definitely had a different plan.
But they refused to execute.
What do you mean they were in the process of executing? He lost the election and had to hand over the keys.
And then Biden made the decision to pull out in May rather than wait till the next fighting, till the end of the fighting season. You don't pull out before the fighting season.
Oh, all right, okay. But was it? I mean, it seems like these things are so. They're so disorganized from the get-go. I mean, when you don't know what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish.
No, they knew what they were trying to do. The limitations placed upon them by the National Command Authority were just, it was a farce. We should have never done it the way we did it. And And, you know, the military guys did try to stand up for it, but they had to roll over.
Well, what was the story about the, what we thought was an Afghan army? We thought those guys could hang together for 90 days, didn't they all, like, disappear overnight or something? Wasn't that part of the problem?
Yes, that was part of the problem.
Is that sort of the same thing that happened in Vietnam, or no, it was so long ago?
No, I don't think Vietnam was quite so bad, but, you know, we were trying to build up the Afghan army forever, and the reward for those general officers was, you know, keep inflating the numbers of the Afghan army. It was a ghost army the entire time. It's just
really
it was just because it was the success factor of whoever was in charge over there, that they always had to make sure their numbers were good.
It's metrics are a wonderful thing, and people should be reporting them. But sooner or later, you have to verify that they aren't just being made up. As we know very well with the economic numbers that get released on a regular basis, that unless you take a deep dive into it, if you're just taking people's word for it, you're going to get BS.
I think one of the most...
That is an aspect of Goodhart's Law.
I was just going to say, we had... You weren't listening, I don't think, at the time. Like, we had his professor on. Is he still alive, Kevin? He was like 90.
Yeah, he is, and it's, you know, his Goodhart's Law is... It comes up in the quality management world all the time. I teach it. When a statistic becomes a target, it loses its value as a statistic.
Yeah.
Now, that sounds like mumbo jumbo, but the real point of it is that when you say this statistic has to be in a certain spot at a certain time, then whatever you need to do to make it go there, you will, which could be fraudulent stuff, but it could just be bad decisions that move the statistic. The important part is that when you have a metric, it is what are the activities, you know, that's what's important. What are the activities that you have to undertake that will improve the metric? But, you know, that's how you measure whether your activities are effective. Not, you know, it's not in itself. You know, for instance, if you're making parts, you're making parts and you have a tolerance. Well, you're looking at your variance numbers and you're looking at you look at the mean, you look at your averages for quality and, you know, scrap and productivity and things like that. But you move the mean with activities, not just by moving the mean. Because if you tell me, the example that Goodhart uses all the time is, if you tell me I have to make 1,000 nails an hour, I'm going to make very little nails. If you tell me I have to make, 1,000 pounds of nails an hour, then I'm going to make really big nails.
Railroad spikes.
Yeah, railroad. I'll make railroad spikes. So, you know, that's the point, is you're going to get exactly what you're rewarding. Whereas if you say, I really want you to undertake activities that are going to improve our productivity, or I want you to undertake activities that are going to improve the quality of the products we make, that's a whole different thing. And then the statistic has value as measuring the effectiveness of that activity.
Well, Mike,
does that make sense? Is that a sensible explanation?
Well, I guess what I'm going to ask Mike is, all through the history of, well, in my lifetime and the stuff I've read about, every army seems to do that. I mean, the French on paper were way, way stronger than the Germans, weren't they, World War II?
Yes, they were. Well, but the French were relying upon that wall, the Maginot Line.
Yeah.
And, you know, static positions don't work against a type of, well, the Blitzkrieg that the Germans use. So.
But, I mean, the Iranians, when we, Iraq won, didn't they have like 90 bazillion tanks, way more than us? But how many could start on a given day, right?
Well, that's the whole thing. You know, that's some of the issues with the Russian army too. Is their maintenance was lacking?
Did you ever, way back when we were doing crazy stuff about war and so forth, in the '60s, there was a movie Strategic Air Command with Rock Hudson. You ever see that movie?
Yeah, I think so.
But it speaks to, you know, it's just a funky movie, but it speaks to just what we're talking about right now. Because they were at the SAC base out in Omaha or someplace, Mike, the big one out there. And they would have these things called operational readiness exams, where somebody'd fly in a private plane from Washington. He'd land and he'd say, okay, we're going to war in like 30 minutes. And everybody had to hop to it. I mean, they had to, all the lights, the traffic lights all turned green to the base and everything you could possibly do to get people there. And in a half hour, you had to get X number of B-52s, not just there they are, up in the air and going. And it's a whole different program to say you've got 50 B-52s and say, when I show up, 45 of them better be in the air in a half hour. That's a whole different world, isn't it?
Yes, and we had the same thing at Bragg. We used to have operational readiness exercises once a month. And the DRB, the Deployable Ready Battalion and Brigade, had to meet their metrics. And, you know, you had to get them up in the air and deploying to, let's say, Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, or to go to Haiti or wherever. But we had to do that every so often. So, and then every month we had what was called it wasn't every month, but once a year we had a big maintenance exercise, and they would come in and inspect us, and that was all, you know, at a moment's notice.
Well, how many, if you guys had, I'll pick a number, 30 fighter jets, how many of them at any given time can you take off with?
I don't know the Air Force stuff, Tom. I have no idea.
But I mean, even the other stuff. How many tanks aren't you pulling a part out of one for the other while you're waiting for a part? I mean,
you usually in a unit every month you had to report your maintenance status. So most units were at least at 90%. If you went below 90%, then you were in trouble.
Well, if you go around the world, I mean, you guys are in Germany. Obviously, Germany has a lot of trains, a lot of everything there. What if you've got a place, I don't know my geography, the Red Sea here, so help me. Where exactly are destroyers, like, gassing up and getting more shells and all that stuff? Is there any place?
Well, they could gas up in Cyprus, let's say. They could gas up in Israel. They could gas up perhaps in Alexandria in Egypt. You know, there's any number of places that with, you know, friendly, with allied forces that they could get stuff. Or they'll just go into a port and pay.
But I mean, so I'm saying, but how do you reload your bullets? And how do you reload food? I mean, those
they have supply ships for all that stuff. The Navy is pretty well supplied to resupply their ships.
Wasn't that the big problem was it 2 weeks ago, Kevin? Lou was talking about one of the oilers that follows the aircraft carrier for the aviation fuel and stuff ran aground or something. They didn't have another one within like 2,000 miles.
Yeah, don't remember the details. But
yeah, it was some story like that, wasn't it? The guy ran aground or somehow screwed the thing up, and there wasn't another one.
Yeah, so, the former captain.
Yeah, well, I would say the former.
Yeah, the former captain, the guy that got relieved.
is there any easier way to get relieved than to run aground or whack into another ship?
If you're in the Navy, I don't think there is an easier way.
Oh God!
Well, it happened to the guy that was commanding the Cole. You know, when that little Zodiac boat hit them, and then he got relieved right away too. So.
Well, I mean, it must be your fault, or it's got to be somebody's fault, right? It's not somebody up.
Well, it's somebody's fault, and they got to make sure somebody falls for it.
Yeah, remember the John Wayne movie In Harm's Way, where he was out with the cruiser. They weren't there at Pearl Harbor when it got hit, so he took off for where he thought the Japanese might be, so he could, you know, with one cruiser he's going to do something, and he gets torpedoed. So they of course bring him up on charges that he wasn't zigzagging. Of course, he didn't have any gas. I mean, he was pretty much out of gas.
Right.
And so the admiral says to him, well, you know, we're going to have to knock you down a peg for a while. But he says that in 6 months, somebody who points their ship toward the battle and heads there as fast as he can is going to be getting awards instead of being knocked down a peg. you know, because now it's all just blame everywhere. So it's you go through cycles like that, I guess. All right, so, we got a little bit of time. What about some sport? Where Mike, since you haven't had a while, where is your assessment in the middle of the year of NIL? Is it is everybody forgetting about it because the games are on, or is it growing? I mean, it seems like it's probably
no. I think to some degree the NIL hurts. Well, it's hurting it in my mind. I mean, what do you call Riley Leonard? You know, he's a good example. You know, he's improved, and you know, he's getting some arm strength back. So who knows? But the guy that, for instance, that's at Florida State, you know, the DJ Ugalele or whatever his name, you know,
I go with Ugalele all the time.
He's the you know, he's on his third team, and obviously the guy's not a leader. So, you know, he didn't lead at Clemson. He didn't lead at Oregon State. He's not leading at FSU. So the nil for him is ridiculous. You're wasting money on that guy.
Well, so, you mean, you know, who's paying him? Do you have an idea?
I'm sure some Florida State alumni group is paying him. It's what I would say.
Well, I guess I'm trying to, as you know, I'm always looking at the shekels, which I probably shouldn't be. But to me, if it's Nike paying him and it's a Nike school, I can sort of get that. If it's a dealership paying him, I don't know what the dealership gets out of it. But now this guy from Notre Dame, isn't Dick Sports sort of involved? But is Dick Sports a sponsor in Notre Dame? What do they get out of it? Is they going to put his picture at Dick Sports? I'm trying to figure out the money somewhere along the line. No matter, you have to answer to somebody, even if it's to yourself or your wife or whatever. If you blow $1 million on somebody, I guess you can say, I blew $1 million on a guy at Notre Dame, and Notre Dame won yesterday, and I checked in the shower to see if the good part grew an inch. I guess I could be that much of an idiot, but I don't think too many people really are when you're talking money like that. I mean, clearly Under Armour thinks that if Notre Dame wins and it's an Under Armour school, there's way more crap coming out of the bookstore, which I'm sure they're right about. Now, the auto dealer, I guess if the guy shows up and you sell a few cars, you might make it work, but how do you just... Dick Sports, or are we going to give this guy $1 million? How do you say that to your shareholders? I mean,
they're making a bet that he's going to be a celebrity as the quarterback from Notre Dame. And if he was very successful and they were rated in the top three or four now, because they, you know, if they hadn't lost to Northern Illinois, and if he were considered very successful, you know, he's got some charm about him. You know, he's got that baby face and a pretty smile and all that. So he could be a good spokesman. It's, you know, that would be no different than, Caleb Williams last year doing all those Dr. Pepper commercials. There was no affiliation specifically with USC on that. It was really just a matter of they had a celebrity quarterback and doing endorsements for them.
Which I think is the original. That's what I'm trying to say, is that if you list the different types of NIL payments, I'm up to like five. And some I can understand and some I can't, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, you know, I never envisioned beforehand that we would have these collectives, and I think they're kind of the bane of the whole thing. But I would also say at some point, and you've kind of gotten to this at different points, Tom, at some point people are going to expect some return. So, you know, if you're squandering $1 million, and I'm not talking about Dick's Sporting Goods, I'm talking about some kind of collective that is funding the football staff, somebody's going to take the fall. Somebody will take the fall, and maybe it's going to mean a much faster trigger for some of these coaches who, if they don't succeed, sorry, coach, we invested $2 million in your payroll, and you ain't delivering. You're out of here.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that if you have a celebrity QB or a basketball team, if one of the girls is drop-dead gorgeous and she's making it, that somebody who's an alumnus or doesn't try and find a way where every one of the schlump linemen get $50,000 a year so they don't feel like they're totally left out. Otherwise, you can't just have the quarterback making $2 million and nobody else getting nothing, because nobody's going to protect the guy. I wouldn't. I mean, right? I mean, so, I mean...
No, you're going to create dissension, yes.
So somewhere along, it doesn't surprise me that there's these different levels. You would think that for once in our life, you know, I was going to say the Federal Reserve is ahead of the game instead of behind. That's never going to happen. But you would think the IRS would be already publishing something that says, look, this you can do, this you can't. The idea that that, you know, you and I can donate $100,000 to Mike Murphy's fund and as a tax deduction, and he hires John Flanagan. John Flanagan, an athlete? That'd be tough. John Flanagan to go to hospitals 4 hours a week and pay him $1,000 an hour when he's at the hospitals and try and say that's tax deduction. I don't know. That kind of stinks to me. But, I mean, where are we on all that? I mean, are these guys, are they getting 1099s? Are they getting W-2s? I know I shouldn't dig into the detail, but sometimes the detail is a big thing in life, right? Just saying.
Well, I would guess they're 1099 employees. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, that's what I would say too, Kevin. They're probably contracted somehow.
And, if the school and those kind of guys, well, obviously in Dr. Pepper, that's none of the school's business. That's a Supreme Court thing in a nutshell, right? I mean, he should be able to go get a Dr. Pepper commercial. And I don't think any of us have a problem with that, do we?
No.
My question is, how far down the line is it? Is he getting that only because he's a Southern Cal quarterback? Or is he getting it? Is he wearing his Southern Cal hat? Is he wearing his, you know, Southern Cal jersey? There's all kinds of slices to this, isn't there?
I don't remember him doing anything specifically wearing the Southern.
I don't either. But
Nor did I pay a whole lot of attention to what Caitlin Clark was doing her last year at Iowa. In that regard, too, I don't know how much Iowa stuff we saw on her, if it was just Caitlin Clark.
But now even her, right? What is? I mean, Michael Jordan. I'm going to say probably started it all. I mean, Arnold Palmer maybe. Well, he was the guy who started it all totally. But I mean, Michael Jordan was able to. So far, I am away from women's sports, but I mean, there were a bunch of people that were robbing people to go buy Michael Jordan sneakers. So Nike, I think, made a lot of dough.
Or they were robbing people of the sneakers.
Yeah, or robbing them of the sneakers. But I mean, they were $90 sneakers when you could buy a pair of sneakers for $30, right, or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to say it was worth it to Nike. Now, whether it was worth it to the neighborhood, I don't know. But now, is there a Caitlin Clark line of basketball shoes that every young girl has to have? I don't think there is.
Yeah, she has her lines, and there's all kinds of people that have their lines. From the women's basketball standpoint, what's interesting about it is, the star men's basketball players are still making much more money in endorsements across the board. You're seeing a lot more in women's basketball now, and that's partly, piggybacking on the Caitlin Clark's popularity. But even before she had her big deals, I was seeing, Arike Ogunbowale doing commercials with Mark Cuban on for State Farm, and I was seeing Jewel Lloyd has a State Farm commercial out. So they were getting there were some of these other major endorsements as well. Now, this was when they were pros, because they weren't eligible to do that when they were in college. But you may recall, after Notre Dame's women won the national championship a few years ago, you may recall Ogunbowale going on Dancing with the Stars.
And she was a hell of a good dancer, as I recall.
And she wasn't bad.
Yeah.
She wasn't bad at it. She was dancing in basketball shoes, though.
Wasn't she dancing with the manager of the Cubs? Were they there on there at the same time?
I don't know. I don't remember.
But I guess Mike, put on your economic hat here. I think you met him. Remember Kendall, the African American dude who works for the mortgage company? He was with us one night having drinks. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah, I don't know, Tom.
But he was telling me that Kendall knows an awful lot of people in the hood. And knows a lot about the economic stuff. Really bright, nice guy. And he was telling me one of his buddies, his son, just got well into the six-figure contract from some shoe place in high school. So I didn't want to grill him. I said, what's that all about? And he goes, I don't know. It's making me pretty worried, actually, because, like I said, Kendall's a thoughtful dude. And what do you think if I give 150G to some kid senior year, what am I buying? Am I buying? There's no way I'm putting, little Mike Murphy's at senior year in high school on a pair of shoes, and somebody's going to go buy him. Who the hell even knows? Even if he's, unless he's the young Will Chamberlain, who the hell even knows who the guy is? What am I buying? Am I buying the kid's future? Am I able to direct him to the college that I've got the stuff there?
You are buying, future. you know, future viability with them. So basically, you're putting them on retainer. But the thing is, if you think that that's going to be honored, you know, if he's a minor, he can't sign a contract. So it's just, you know, it's a
deal.
Well,
the old man signed it.
You're hoping for loyalty in return.
Well, the old man signed it, probably, or a mom.
Well, the old man can't sign a contract to indenture his son.
Well, back to the question. What am I getting here? If I'm
you're hoping you're getting loyalty. You're hoping they're
yeah,
gonna
and at minimum you're getting some goodwill. You know.
Well, am I when if I who's the new coach in Notre Dame? We'll pick basketball here for a second.
Shrewsbury.
Okay, so now he finds a guy in Mike Murphy's hood. They really could put the ball down, right? And he calls up Mike. He says, "You ever heard of this guy?" Mike, are you going to say, forget about him. Nike just gave him 200 grand. There's no way he's going to an Under Armour school. Is that now part of the equation coming out of high school?
Well, I think that's been part of the equation for a long time. You know, those shoe contracts were, you know, a way to get to channel people to different schools.
But, I mean, I'm talking about high school. And maybe that's been happening
a while.
Well,
that's that Sonny Vaccaro was signing. He's probably signing kids in high school and then getting them to the school that he wanted to go to.
Well, he was a AAA guy, right?
Huh?
Was he the AAA guy?
No,
AAU.
No. He was a AAU. Shoe guy.
Oh, yeah. But, Vaccaro had... He had his camps, you know, his Nike camps and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I guess my question then is, does the Notre Dame basketball coach have to go through him to get to the kid?
He might have to, yeah. Who knows?
Sometimes you go to the parents. Sometimes you go to the high school basketball coach. Sometimes you go to the AAU coach, and it's always been that way.
Well, is the NIL stuff... upset that? Is the AAU coach down a notch or up a notch because of this?
Well, they may still be the main influencers, but you may also now have another party in there that is signing the endorsement checks.
Do you think anybody, let's say they're supposed to be a little special, like they keep thinking they are, do you suppose the Notre Dame Board of Directors, I mean, if I was on, of course they never put me on it, I'd want to know at the end of the year, I'd want a complete 50-page report of who got paid what, where, and who was getting paid by people, and what, and if it was worth it, and where all the money went. Do you think anybody would give that to the board of directors, or anybody's making
it? Well, I don't know if I'd give it to their trustees, not directors, but same thing. So there, Notre Dame is an example. The trustees are very, very much ceremonial. They all think they have an important role, but they really don't. It's the Board of Fellows that is a small group of
it's like Harvard.
People who are trustees. But aside from that, if I tell you what, if I were the president of the university, because the presidents are responsible for oversight of athletics, that's been pretty clear from the NCAA. So, if I were the president, yeah, I would absolutely want to see, you know, what those cash flows look like. What, you know, effectiveness, I don't know. You know, did we win more games or anything like that? I don't know how you would. I'd have to think about how you measure effectiveness on that. But if I would want an accounting of it, I want to know where the money's coming and where the money's going.
What if you were the UCLA guy and started talking about how much money now we're spending to send softball teams and volleyball teams all over the place? What are we doing here? I mean, they have to be wondering if they made the right move with this Big Ten, don't you think?
I would like to think so, yeah. Any rational person has to be asking that question.
I just was – I was surprised, and I know most people say, what difference does it make? But I was surprised that the when people lob out numbers, you know, the UCLA, like, has to do this. So I look at the budget of UCLA, and it's – what did I say it was, $11.2 billion? So they have to make a move in football to get $20 million more on TV rights? I don't think, Mike, if we're on the board there, I don't even think we want that one on the agenda, do we? What's $20 million?
Well, I think because the Pac-10 or Pac-12 was collapsing, they had to make some move. So, and, you know, in answer to your other question, I would hope somebody in the athletic department is paying close attention to, you know, how the nil money is being used and how effective it is. That's where I would start with the management of the nil money, but who knows?
Do you think they even know?
And it is that, you know, they have a compliance group. I mean, that would seem to be the place where it would go.
Well, do you think they would even know? I mean,
yeah, I think they would know how much they're getting and then the effectiveness of it. I mean,
well, stupid question. As you say in high school, there are no such thing as stupid questions. If the three of us decide Stocks and Jacks all of a sudden had $1 gazillion and we wanted to pay, you know, we're going to hire all the Notre Dame offensive linemen for a softball tournament, you know, in some huge park for a weekend just to stand out there and talk to people. We give them all $100,000. Do we have any obligation to tell the university we did that? I don't think so, do we?
No, but the university may have an obligation for their athletes to report their earnings.
Well, that's kind of the question I'm getting to. Do you think they do?
I would hope they do, but who knows?
Why would you?
Well, because as what you just said or Kevin just said it, that we have compliance people, and we have to comply with whatever the NCAA regs are.
Well, I mean, does Southern Cal, do they have to know that Caleb Williams made $5 million on Dr. Pepper commercials? What business is theirs, according to the Supreme Court?
It isn't, but they may still be. They may, and I don't know. I don't know what they actually have done. I know what I would do in that situation. You know, outside income is always a dicey situation. Because they call them student athletes, it's an extracurricular activity that probably creates a little bit different, maybe kind of a dicey situation about what they can compel the athletes to do with things that are outside of the athletics purview. So maybe they don't, but that's what I would be doing, is saying, hey, I just want to report. I'm not going to stop you from earning anything. We just want to know. And, you know, if you really want to do right by the athletes who are there for, you know, they're working for you, and they're working, you know, as far as the school is going, they're working for cheap. So if you really, really want to do right by them, you want to be able to advise them. You want to be able to help them out on making sure nobody's taking advantage of them, that their money that they are promised is actually paid, that they understand the tax implications of it, and that they're planning accordingly. You know, all those kinds of things. That would be, I would think it would be incumbent on them to give that kind of advice to their athletes. One is because they don't want it to reflect badly on the school, and then number two is so that you know, it's just a right thing to do for the people who are working for you.
I hate to.
And some schools will be more inclined to do that than others.
Mike, is Kevin going to be real upset if I accuse him of sounding like a FINRA bureaucrat?
That's just reality, Tom.
Well, I'm saying the reason why I say
Tom, if you do accuse me of that, just know, because I don't have the camera on, I am giving you the finger.
The reason why, as you know, Kevin, it hits close to home, and by the way, Kevin would do only the right things, but in our industry, FINRA, every week, some 25-year-old thinks of something else. Mike says to me, I'm doing this painting job. By the way, we can make $500. And I said, gee, I want to see if I can still paint. And Mike gives me $250. If I don't report that to my brother and to FINRA, like if they have any idea, none of it's their business, if I don't report any kind of outside thing like that, I can get censured, so can my bro as our compliance person. I don't want it to get to that, honestly. Because the Supreme Court said, I don't know that it's Southern Cal's business if I'm an extra in a play on a Wednesday night in the summer. I mean, is there some sort of a cursory reporting? Probably. But it's never that. Then it's, if I don't report it and they don't find it, then I can find the school and I can find the kid, and we're right back where we started from, right? I mean, there's a middle ground here, and I know you know the middle ground, and I'm not accusing you, but you got to be careful how far you go with this, because once you get it into some sort of a bureaucratic malaise, you basically can't fart without reporting it, right?
I mean, I'm not suggesting that their job is necessarily to monitor and control and any of that kind of stuff. It is more that their job is What can you do that's right for the athletes?
Right.
And that should always and forever, that should have been the regardless of NIL deals, this should have been the inclination 20 years ago as well, because you are asking people to engage in a sport where they can get injured, yep, where serious things can happen. You're asking them to dedicate a lot of time. At many schools, you're asking them to dedicate that time and still be good students. And, you know, if you're going to put all of that kind of stuff on people, I think you owe them, you owe them a duty of making sure that they are, looking out for their well-being, I guess, is the best way I can say it.
You just don't want to have a congressional act that makes NCAA FINRA.
No, I don't want that at all.
Yeah, I just, it is... When we talk about this, the reason why we're jousting around, we're not disagreeing. We're talking, how many different ways can this go? Mike, have you ever seen anything other than maybe when we were in school and they deregulated all the industries like all at once? Have you ever seen an economic thing like this where it's all of a sudden the Wild West again in our lifetime? I haven't.
No, I haven't either, Tom. You keep bringing up the potential problems and. Who knows how it's eventually going to work out.
How many of these kids are saving his dough for taxes?
Hey, gentlemen, we're well past time, yep, and John's already in.
All right.
I do have to go, so I'm going to check out.
All right,
out.
Bud, you take care. We'll just bring John and Mike. You're welcome to stay, or if you got to do something, because John's coming on, and we'll do a break at 7:30 here. That's a ways away. Mr. Flanagan, you with us?
I am. Good morning, Mike, Tom, Andrew.
Have you been listening in? What don't we know? What are we all wrong on?
What don't I know? You're educating me, guys.
Well, where do you want to start? Pile in. I mean, the sports thing is. Well, first of all, how much money? I mean, let's start with that. The NCAA has gone. Oh, by the way, I don't want to rock you guys. Did you see the state of Illinois? Passed a rule on limiting sports gambling last week.
Yeah.
Do you see that? I think I sent it out. I don't know if you guys read it. You see that, Mike?
No, I didn't see that.
Well, basically, they're banning any sort of betting that any one person can influence. So, in other words, no kinds of bets where the first play of the game will be a pass. Because the coach, if he knows the betting is going there, he can call a pass the first play and win the bet, or his buddies can win. They don't want anything. They don't want. You can't bet on a field goal kicker missing or not missing the kick, and you can't bet on somebody getting hurt. What was the other one, John? Basically, anything that any single person can influence. Well, hell, can anybody influence?
A single play, or it had some other language in it too. I guess that's a step in the right direction, but I find that it's kind of lip service to the bigger problem that there's other ways that games can be fixed and other ways that people can gamble on the outcome and avoid that kind of prohibition. So I think it signifies a willingness to get deeper in the weeds about this stuff than we have in the past. I don't know if it's going to really have the effect of stopping much gambling. I think gamblers do have a way of being creative about this kind of stuff. So I don't know. I mean,
well, it is.
I think it's.
We were young. I mean, when we were young once, I believe that. Because I got pictures of you guys being young. Remember when we weren't even in college yet, were we? When Paul Hornung and Alex Karras. And a few other guys, weren't they suspended a year, Mike?
We were still high school, I think.
Yeah, but it wasn't. I don't. Did they even bet anything, or they just were seen with a gambler? Wasn't it consorting with gamblers?
Yeah, I don't think they did. They were gambling. I could be wrong.
I thought they just were seen with. I mean, I know you. No way an athlete could go in a casino.
I think Karras was gambling, and I bet you Paul Hornung was gambling too.
Maybe, but it wasn't. But wasn't the charge just consorting with gamblers or something, being seen?
I have no idea, Tom. And they were only suspended for a year, but they lost a year of their careers. So,
yeah. Well, I guess my question is: back then, the gambling was nothing like it is now, and back then, people thought that it was a problem. He didn't want your guys hanging around at casinos all off season, because if you run up a big bill, guess how they're going to want to collect. And now all of a sudden we got all the sports gambling. Nobody even thinks of the fact that it could be crooked. And all of a sudden one state legislature said, wait a minute, maybe we've gone a little too far. Let's cut back like just a little bit. Don't you find the whole string of it kind of amazing?
No, it's a joke. You know, I mean, the way that, you know, they, you know, Pete Rose gets banned for life for gambling. Now, granted, he gambled on his own games, but that's going to happen, you know, with these other athletes now, too. There's just too much of an influence now of gambling on the sports. And the fantasy football leagues have done, you know, they're the ones I think that have contributed most to the way that, because of the influence of fantasy football, now, you know, statistics mean something and people are gambling on it.
Is there any, I'm going to ask a really stupid question, because everybody around here is involved in fantasy football. Some of them are, you know, are the basic ones that I guess we could do. There's other ones, like the one Thomas is in, our guy used to help us out. Their draft is like 8 hours. You're drafting specific defensive guys and not just the defense. But the standard one is you get, what, 3 or 4 offensive guys, you got a defense, and you get a kicker, right, or something like that.
Right.
And then, but then now there's ones where you actually draft defensive people and tackles and interceptions and all. It gets really – is there any big money on that? I guess there is, but I've never seen one that was big, though.
There's big money because in some of these leagues you're paying $10,000 to play.
Oh, really? You know? I didn't know they were up that high. Okay.
Well, I'm sure they're up pretty high. You know, these wealthy guys, who knows?
Well, so I mean, now all of a sudden – I mean, to me, the danger is always you're not going to come into somebody – you know, somebody like us, and said, hey, I want you to throw the dorm game for $50, you know. I mean, but if all of a sudden we were in hock to a drug dealer or a casino and said, by the way, you're throwing this game tonight, that's a whole different program, right?
Yeah.
I'm more concerned about these guys gambling in the off season than I am during the season. And how much was Charles Barkley supposedly in the hole before he got these jobs on TV?
I have no idea. And Jordan used to gamble a lot, too. So
I don't know that he ever went in a hole, did he? I mean, I don't know.
I have no idea, Tom.
Because, I mean, I think Barkley was seriously in the hole. So was it Iverson, or did he just spend his dough?
I didn't pay that much attention to it. I was overseas, so.
Well, there was a list on my it's the Quora stuff that somehow I get something like 10 NBA players that, you know, lost all their dough, and whether they gambled it or spent it on God knows what, entourages or whatever. And I think Barkley was a big gambler. And as soon as, but now that he's got these TV things, he's back flush. He was able to pay everybody off. And I think it was after he was playing. But I mean, there's a lot of people that get the gambling bug. I mean, it's not like it's I know a couple of people that did, and marriages suffered and everything else. And How do people not anticipate that it could go wrong real quick, right? I mean, I don't even know. Yeah. How did his guy ever get that kind of a line of credit to lose that dough?
Well, because Otani has big bucks contracts. So,
but I mean, the guy must have had access to his checking account somehow.
Somehow, you're right.
But I mean, last time, you and I, Mike and I used to play cards all the time. Mike's a great card player. We used to play poker and bridge all the time. But, I mean, every time I went to Vegas, if I went down and put $100 on the Bears, which I used to do and never won, I don't think, as my mother said, you're way too smart to bet on Notre Dame or the Bears because you're betting with your heart and not your head. Well, of course, did I ever pay attention to her? No. But, I mean, you and I go down to put a bet down, Mike, we'll bring John with us. We don't say, I want $100 on the Bears, put it on my check or put it on the cuff. We give the guy $100, right?
Yeah, right.
But, I mean, how do you get to the point where you can run up a – I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, I could go up to – I don't know. I mean, I could go up to somebody in the Tripoli tap that I know maybe he'll take a bet and say, I'll call him and put me $100 on the Bears, and he knows I'm good for it. I don't think I could say, put $10,000 down, but I'll see if I lose. Who the hell would do that? Unless they knew where I lived or had access to my checking account.
I'm sure some of those bookies would have that information.
Probably, but I never wanted to go on a debt to that. Did you?
No, I don't. I wouldn't do that. So
yeah, I mean, we've seen guys go to the blackjack table and say, you know, give me a marker for $5,000. And I'm looking at him like, you're going to borrow money to play blackjack? What are you, some kind of moron? But evidently there's people that do that, right?
Yeah, there's plenty of morons out there.
Well, that's the truth. All right, what haven't we covered, John, with Mike, before we, we talked about three wars. Where do you, the Chinese have been pretty silent the last 6 months. What are they thinking, Mike? We haven't been able, when I say silent.
Well, everything's going their way. It's chaos in the world, and, you know, they think long term. Everything's going the way they want. The only thing, I just hate to, I do not want to see the dollar not be the reserve currency for the world, and we are weakening the dollar, you know, all the time. So, who knows?
Okay, well, that's an economic question for the Bodeus, as they say in the South Side. We, you and I, went to many economics classes together. You and I know that constantly pushing dollars into the system weakens the dollar, weakens us, weakens every man, and yet it strengthens the living bejesus out of people that own assets and stocks to where they make money on versus other people every single day. The only good thing we got going with us is a lot of people that never used to have 401ks and IRAs, and, you know, clients like mine are benefiting from it as well to a certain extent, but I don't have it, but not everybody's got stock, right? And so how, if you're the Fed, how do you serve this other monster of wealth bubble? Is somewhat recent, I would say, wouldn't you? How do you get that one off the table? It's on the table, and the Fed is very aware of it. I will say that, and I'll swear on that. They are not going to do anything that drops this market 25%. I mean, people think that the percent a week in their some of these stocks is their right now. And how do you do both? I'm asking Mike, and then you, Jen.
I thought the Fed has a responsibility to keep a strong dollar and to keep unemployment at below a certain rate.
It's employment and inflation, but you just lie about the inflation.
Well, and they're probably lying about the employment. They are lying about the employment because they said, you know, they had to do a cut of 818,000 jobs or whatever it was. You know, but that's just the government essentially lying to us. You know, false stats or whatever. So
why doesn't, I mean, this question's for Jen. Why doesn't, what has changed in the press where the three of us and the other people on the show, we're going to say, hey, these numbers are kind of weird. You'll never hear that if you retape Fox Business, maybe something on Bloomberg. CNBC, you'll never hear anybody question any of this stuff. Once in a while, you'll get a guy on there saying, boy, you know, these CPI numbers are a little lighter. I mean, why is it? I don't know if you were in my first economics class with me, Mike, but you might have been. When the first professor, I remember saying, this unemployment number, the unemployment rate number is the most useless number in all of economics. And here it is 50 years later, damn near, and people are still looking at it. It's the amount of people out of a job that are looking for work in somebody's mind. They're 3% of the people that actually aren't working. It's an insane number to look at.
It's a psychological shell game. And I do see columnists in newspapers now openly calling these statistics, you know, bald-faced lies. And, you know, it's been a cover-up for a long time, and nobody should put any stock in them at all, and people, you know, are much more likely now to get stuff published saying that wasn't the case 10 years ago at all. I mean, these numbers were sacrosanct, but then there was a lot more trust in the data generally, and they were freer in publishing it too. And of course now they're very stingy about what they publish, and what they do publish you can't trust at all anymore. And I think there really is a rebellion against this,
but they're silent rebellions. And I mean, who's your champion? I mean, Milton Friedman's dead. I mean, who's your champion? Or isn't it one?
Well, I don't think it's going to be an economist that's going to be the champion either. It's going to be, a political gadfly or, you know, a journalist or something that doesn't necessarily have to have the credentials that a professor would have, that's going to blow this thing enough so that other people will be emboldened to call it for what it is.
But who would let Who would let Milton Friedman write a column today? Or one of us?
Oh, well, I mean, there's a lot of people less talented than he is who get all the, you know, airtime and column space that they want, and they just keep lying over and over. It isn't like a pure system than it was with Friedman at all. It's there isn't a lot of room for people that talented anymore.
Well, when
they'd be prophets crying in the wilderness.
I mean, you were being a good attorney. Mike was helping us stay out of war, and I was working for Pullman, and I was doing the CPI adjustments back when, you know, when we had a lot of inflation, maybe almost as much as now, but and then we knew we had it. And you know, Mike, I never, if the CPI came out and we were up, you know, 2% in the quarter, I would look at the 2%. I'd adjust the price for the MBTA cars for 60 cars was like $500,000 a car. So say it was $40 million. I would sit there and go, 2%, put my little calculator together, and I'd say, all right, the price of the cars, the contract is now, you know, $40,800,000. And I'd call up the guys at Boston, I'd say, here's my number, and they'd say, so that's our number too. The thought, I mean, I would never have, if you asked me, I wouldn't have said, you know, I was going to put my neck on the chopping block that the number was 2% instead of 1.9 or 2.1. But it was, nobody questioned that it wasn't in the ballpark, that it was really 4, it was really 0. I mean, what if the three of us, I mean, people are supposed to use these numbers for like real stuff. What if the three of us would have gotten we should have done this. Well, no, we shouldn't, we'd be broke. Decided to build houses for somebody in a neighborhood and said, we're going to deliver you 10 houses a year, roughly the same, you know, the same kind. And by the way, our current price in 2014 would be, we'll get you the house for $300,000 and we'll do a CPA up on it. I'm going to say that we are hopelessly broke today. If we're having to do that house for say $360 10 years later and deliver it to this guy, I'll bet if it really cost us that much 10 years ago, it's got to be 5 now. I think we're totally out of business. What do you guys think?
Yep.
Well, you're probably right, Tom, but you know, people would have changed their pricing structures and all that other stuff.
We would have been hoping to amend, but if it's 10-year contract, the guy goes, looks to me like a contract, you three idiots. The CPI wouldn't be helping us at all, right?
Well, that's true. So,
I mean, normally, I mean, when we signed a contract with Boston, we Pullman, there was never any. By the way, if there was no clause in there that said if the CPI looks like it's totally screwed up, we'll get together and discuss it. Why would anybody even thought of that?
But well, now, yeah, who knows?
This is the unstable climate we live in now, Tom.
Are we going to have a quick break,
a
Mike?
Lot more information available now, Tom. You know, you were talking about, you know, the internet has allowed people to do more research, and they have an outlet for kind of all kinds of outlandish theories. The internet essentially has really changed the way we live.
I think it has too. But we're going to go to break here, Mike. I'm going to ask the both of you guys a question. Maddie Weber and I used to argue about this all the time. Maddie would say, and I can't really disagree, that the internet has created a much easier outlet for information, and people can access information better than they ever can. And my response is, that's probably true, except we've got 60% of the amount of actual reporters digging up the news that we used to have. So what exactly are we reading that's so much easier to read? We'll go to break, and you guys can ponder that and explain to me where the conundrum is there. S&P futures down 1, NASDAQ futures up 1. We're kind of back to flat here. I think we're going to be like this all the way to the election, but we'll see. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market, It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Low North Bank Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, on the board. SP Futures unched, as they used to say, on the trading floor. NASDAQ Futures up 9, Dow Futures down 90. Most of that is because of Caterpillar, which is down 11.50 at crummy earnings. We've got Amgen down 420, but we've got Amazon up 397, so mostly it's all Caterpillar. Remember that the multiplier here is about $7. So if a stock in the Dow is down a dollar, that's $7 in the average. It's somewhat counterintuitive, but that happens every time you put a new stock in. You got to do all these adjustments, and it used to be like 8.5, but it's down to like 6.9. But it's still, it's a multiplier. We're in Asia, Nikkei up 373, that's a full 1%. Hang Seng down 320, 1.5%. Shanghai down 20.6%. When we come back, I definitely want to remember to ask Mike what his views are, what's going on over in China, because normally Russell does that for us on Wednesday, and Mike can take over for Russell on that. We're in Europe, FTSE down 48.6%, DAX down 226, 1.1%, ouch. CAC Iran down 116, 1.6%, so Europe in a funk today. Yesterday, Dow was down 154, S&P up 9, NASDAQ was up 145, so again, we had a mixed market here a little bit. Bonds, these turned, the interest rates turned down yesterday after the auction, so the 10-year is 4.27, come down just a little bit. The Bund 2.33 unchanged, Japan unchanged 0.96. Oil, which has been coming down, today is up 78 cents, but still 67.99. Remember last week it was like 74 that one day. Brent up 78 cents, 71.90. Natural gas down 2 cents, 2.83. RBOB up a penny, 1.96, still under $2. Gold up 8.50, record high 27.89. Silver down 21 cents, 34.22. Again, those guys aren't all trading together lately either. A lot of stuff goes wacky. Foreign exchange, euro is 108. This was 110.5, I'm going to say, 5 weeks ago. So that's pushing a 2.5, 3% move. That's a lot. British pound, 129.5. They're hanging in there. They were at 130.5 for a while, but the euro is the one that's getting clunkered here a little bit. And we've got crypto, which has been on a tear. Today down 963, but still 71,874, still over 70,000. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:35 here in Chicago on a Wednesday, October 30th. As with sports, we just had the fourth game of the World Series, and the Yankees won over the Dodgers, 11-4, getting rid of the Dodgers' three-game winning streak. But over Chicago weather, it is currently 69 degrees. Going to be a bit of a high one today as we get cool throughout the week. But today, it is all about the wind as well. It is windy with the record-breaking temperature of 76. There will be a high fire risk, and holiday decorations can be blown around if not secured. That's what it says right here. We're going to have a high of 79. Over in Phoenix, things are a lot more simple. They're at 53 degrees. They are going to have a high of 75, so a bit of a cooler one out there. They're going to have sunny skies as well. Now, finally, for Chicago traffic, things are looking... Let's see. Excuse me for one moment.
I'd turn back if I were you.
Yep, just loaded in here, and that's about exactly what we got. No major accidents to report, it looks like, but on the inbound expressways, traffic is heavy. If you're on the outbound, keep watch for the Eisenhower and the Kennedy. Thankfully, again, no major accidents to report. Back to you, Chief.
So, in the unlikely event, guys, that the Dodgers lose the next two games, now, do they give that champagne back to the dealer, or do they take it with them back to New York? L.A., or do they buy new champagne in L.A.?
I'm sure they're probably putting the champagne on the plane back to L.A.
do you use good champagne, or all you do is squirt it at everybody?
Well, I'm sure it's not good champagne, but who knows?
Oh.
Okay. All right. The question was on the table. What's the answer? What are you guys thinking?
You had mentioned about, you know, if you have 60% of the news investigators that we used to have, it doesn't really matter what kind of, you know, sophisticated retrieval system you have for the news if the actual news that you've assembled is already much inferior to what it used to be. And I was thinking in the gap, you know, between the segments here, to bring up the issue of Beyonce and the Democratic Party.
Yeah, what was that all about? I just heard
bits. Well, you know, the whole thing last weekend where, you know, the rumor is that Beyonce was paid $10 million by the Harris campaign to give a four-minute speech. I don't know what she would have charged him to do one song or 10 songs.
We would have done it. We'd have done it for $1 million.
The event was billed as a performance, and of course the media was really, you know, whipping up interest in this rally because she was going to appear. I mean, that's disappointing enough, I guess. Now they substituted Willie Nelson at the last minute.
God, how old is he?
91. So I don't think that was likely to blend in with any of the expectations of the crowd. So that's clearly a bad decision all the way around. But Tom, what really made me think about this was that 2 months ago at the Democratic convention in Chicago, it was either the second to the last night or the last night of the convention, the media in Chicago and nationally was all abuzz that Beyonce was going to appear at the convention. And I remember watching all the local people, the WBBM, all the local anchors in Chicago who were covering the convention were just giggling to themselves. Well, Beyonce, I hear the United Center is going to be the Beehive tonight, and it was shameless promoting a total non-event. I mean, I don't think she was even in the United States, maybe. She certainly wasn't in Chicago, and she wasn't at the United Center that night. And 2 months ago, everybody forgot about that. And here we have a reprise of this last weekend, the same kind of bait and switch. At least she showed up for the rally, but there was no performance, as the media was touting and as the Harris campaign was touting too. But how quickly people forgot. We've been in this situation before, and
how do you keep track of all this stuff?
Only one shame on me for, you know,
how do you keep track of all this stuff? The news, they used to say in a trading floor, is like,
well, that's the thing. Yeah. In a cycle like this, where there's so much so-called news, and a lot of it is just hot air and blather, it easily drowns out, you know, your recollections of things, so that you begin to forget more than you think you're learning. So,
well, Mike, Mike, the example, and Jens knows about this, when the former police chief was caught for the drunk driving thing, right? And he was at the Ceres Cafe, and once in a while, you actually, you know, see a news story that you know a real lot about. You know, it might be something in my industry. I mean, it's pretty rare, you know, that you actually, you know, see a news story that you actually know the facts. I mean, it might happen once every 5 years. I mean, to me, so they started talking about he was at Ceres Cafe and got trashed, right? Ceres Cafe, you've been there, you know the drinks over there. But I'm sitting there going, he got pinched at, well, he got discovered at 12:30
at night or in the daytime.
Then, well, 12:30 a.m. So at night.
Okay.
So I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. Ceres closes at 8. That leaves one hell of a gap, and yet the story with the first person who wrote it was Ceres Cafe and forgot the part about the 8. So all of a sudden these people come here to news trucks and everybody, and they're interviewing Billy, my buddy over at Ceres, and you could tell by all the articles. I think it was broken by Cranes, Jen, and then but then all of a sudden every newspaper had an article about it. Mike, it looked just like we were in high school, and it was my Latin homework. Like, one guy did the homework, and everybody else copied because nobody wanted any part of Latin. I mean, I'm reading these articles, and I'm going, I can tell every one of these people just looked at the other guy's article, wrote an article, put their name on it, and stuck it in a different paper. But nobody actually went out and interviewed anybody. So finally, it was like a month later where somebody goes, well, yeah, there was another. He was somewhere else for 4.5 hours. and evidently, he was at Ceres with one of his... He had like two or three drivers, 24-hour drivers, and allegedly he was having an affair with like two of them at the same time. Well, that got out pretty quick. Can you imagine? We having a wife at home, and then two of your drivers you're having an affair with. They're not supposed to figure it out. It's an amazing world, isn't it?
Yeah, he was probably at Tripoli in between the series and the 12:30.
Actually, went to what's that Italian place over on east of Michigan Avenue, John? It's been there forever. It's a good place. Just north of the river on like St. Croix or wherever one of those streets are over there.
St. Clair. Oh, yeah.
I guess he was over there for the those guys never even got in a paper for like a month, and I found out via the grapevine that's where he was. And yet series, we're being interviewed, all the trucks are here, and it's, you know, the news is kind of nuts. But I mean, once in a while you get across an article, but you know, does anybody really want the truth? I mean, do we care about it? I mean,
oh yeah, there's a lot of people want the truth, Tom.
Well, and even with that truth, Tom, I wish he were our mayor now instead of the one we have.
Oh, God, yeah. Without a doubt. Well, if you could,
I'll take a little more of that truth and feel like I benefit from the bargain.
Well, I mean, what we got a few minutes. Let's talk a little bit about Chicago, because it's a microcosm, I think, of a lot of what's happening in a lot of other places. You have, you know, shifting, because I don't know what's happening in some of these other places. And Mike, I know you're from Cleveland. I don't know how much close ties you have, but what does an let's pick Akron. What does an Akron do with no tire industry? Is the city smaller than it used to be? I mean, I know they have less population, but have they actually shrunk the size of it? I mean, do you have blocks where you've got street lights and sewer and water, and there's nobody living there? I mean, isn't that what happened in Detroit? They actually gave some of the property to some of the surrounding suburbs or something. I mean, I think in Akron, weren't they putting up parks and a couple of golf courses where people used to live? There's some organized shrinkage that's going on in some of these places, but you're not going to be the old Akron, are you? I don't know that you are. And what do you do when you have that shrinking base and the rich people leave? And it's not an easy deal. I mean, Chicago, I think, has something Kevin was talking about where a new Detroit. One thing Chicago has that Detroit doesn't is an incredible public transportation system, rail and otherwise, which, so people, if you do have something here, for whatever reason, downtown or close to downtown, people can get to work back and forth for $6 a day in what is a pretty good system. Now you got to throw the bums off the system, but that's very politically incorrect, but the people who are there to ride them because they sleep there, by and large, you have an infrastructure that maybe only three or four cities in the country have. So you have something going for you. But what's happening in these other places? I mean, what do you hear about? I mean, Cleveland had a big, I mean, they've lost people. How many people are left in Cleveland itself, Mike?
Yeah, I have no idea, Tom. All I know is Columbus is the highest population in Ohio now, and Cleveland used to be. And, you know, Cleveland is suffering. The industry is, I mean, industry in Cleveland is suffering. Industry in Akron probably is also suffering. And maybe people with foresight have a plan how to, kind of shift. You know, Cleveland gets some tourism and they still have decent industry, but it's not great anymore. You know, the flats is where the steel used to be done, and I think there's still, well, U.S. Steel is still around at least, but I'm not sure how well it's doing.
Well, Columbus says if anybody could pick two things you'd want in your city, you'd want to be the state capital and you want to have the university there. I mean, those two things going for you, you got a couple of legs up on just about everybody, right?
Well, but Columbus has a lot of growth going too. I mean,
right.
That whole, I-71, 75, you know, there's a circle around Columbus that is pretty well developed, and their suburbs are good too. So,
that's where my extended family on the Italian side comes from. But, I mean, we got a university with 90,000 people there. That's a start.
Right.
And, you know, in the state capital, they're never going to go out of business or lay people off, right? So then you got that going for you.
That's true, too.
And we have, matter of fact, I don't know if you ever met her. One of the ladies from my mother's cousin's wife. And when I say that, it's kind of weird, but my grandmother was the oldest of nine. And she actually had sons and daughters older than her brothers and sisters, which I don't think you can see much today, are you? But anyway, so my mother's cousin is maybe only 6 years older than me. So it's, anyway. But his wife is a teacher. You know, you guys, I mean, Mike is, or John was one. She's one of these ladies that every single student she ever had in, like, God knows how many years, and their parents, absolutely has a photographic memory of every one of them. Who's the guy that was the quarterback at Notre Dame? One of her best buddies. The guy who's, the guy from Dublin.
Quinn? Brady Quinn?
Yeah, and the guy 5 years ago was the Ohio State punter, would call her every Saturday morning telling her how nervous he was. I mean, you can't go to a store with her without everybody walking down the aisle. It's either somebody's mom or somebody's dad. Anyway, but you wouldn't believe the amount of players and stuff that come out of that area. She's up in, like, Dublin. That Columbus is a real tight community. I mean, it's much... Well, it's less people, but it's much tighter than Chicago. Everybody knows everybody. It's like you said, Mike, it's small town America that grew up.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, my sister is in Columbus, and there's a Catholic high school that her daughter went to that I'm sure was decent in football, whatever, maybe not.
What's the name of it? I think she taught there.
St. Bridget's.
Oh, but now they lost the cousin I'm talking about. Ohio State, every university has a really beat the crap out of people major. I think ours, that even though the guys in, you know, aerospace and stuff did really worked hard. Remember what we used to do to architects at Notre Dame? That was a 5-year program. You never saw those guys. did anybody ever go out and have a beer with an architecture major? Those guys were beat up for 5 years. Anyway, Ohio State did the same thing in aerospace. And my mother's cousin, he's got to be mid-70s. He can still help his kids with their college calculus homework.
Right.
I can't imagine trying to do a derivative, could you, right now? Good Lord. But he came out of Ohio State in aerospace, and they had some big aerospace company there. They left, and he had his family there, and he never got to pursue his career. Columbus had a lot of huge amounts of aerospace going on there, and they had a lot of parts manufacturers for autos, right?
I think so, and then they also have LexisNexis, too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, but... I guess what I'm saying is, what do you do when you've got, I mean, if you guys, if you're here in the same time, we got some time, we can plunk in the car and drive around. You wouldn't believe what the South Side and West Side looks like here. I mean, there's nobody there. And the people that have still a house, they're the ones that are leaving because the bullets are flying over their head every night. And
I'm surprised Brandon Johnson hasn't proposed a marijuana industry there. I mean, Denver.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, well. Denver has quite a bit of a, you know, a cannabis industry. So, and I'm sure
they're all over the place here,
and California too. So,
well, Mike, if you were here for a cocktail and you walked across the Eisenhower Expressway, which is now some other name, to my truck, you could be half high walking across the street.
Yeah, that's okay.
I mean, it's incredible. You see smoke coming out of the windows in the top of the car. It's like a Western movie where the Indians are the blankets over the smoke.
When I schlep over to the liquor store in my neighborhood a couple times a week, if I just stand on the corner waiting for the light to change, I can get high enough from all the cars passing by that I should turn around and go home.
What we were talking about, not with you guys, I wanted to get your opinion on this. I'm trying a long way of getting there, which is, I guess, my style, lack of style. The people you see around here that are not employed, and, you know, homeless or whatever, they're a lot younger than they used to be, and it seems like they're a lot more messed up. And I don't know, probably need to get our friend Dr. Blade on here. I'm going to say that even if you somehow could corral, which you can't really do, 50 of these people, going to sound awful, hustle them someplace, give them something to wear, wash their clothes, give them a physical, give them a couple of meals, a couple of places where they can actually sleep at night, and assess everybody after 2-3 days. I think you got people in, like, really bad shape. I don't think you're 5 days away, even if you had some kind of a job, of anybody working. I mean, I think the drugs and everything have taken, these are massive tolls on these people. I don't even know what the medical repair work would be or how long it would take, but I don't even think Brandon Johnson, I don't think they want to know the extent of the problem. I think the problem is way worse than anybody even begins to see. I mean, when I say the problem, the solution to the problem is incredibly more difficult than anybody's letting on. I don't think anybody even has a clue, because nobody even cares to know. Am I all
there's
wrong?
A piece, there's a piece in the epic. Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry.
I think, you know, it's, well, whether it's a sanctuary city problem or not, you know, or not, Tom, I think the sanctuary cities have a, they have an unusual problem. And then the work ethic in the United States has suffered over time, and it just isn't there anymore. And the pandemic really hurt that. So I think we need to build up the American work ethic again. And how you do that, I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you, the idea that is being, you know, lobbed out there by, let's say, maybe one side of the aisle, if you actually go to the places that I would drive you by, the tent, where the tents and stuff are, 95% of those people are white. They're not people. And a matter of fact, what do you want to call the people who came over the border? There's a spot right by me, and they've been there a yearish. And now in the morning when I drive by on the way to work, I see at least half of them heading toward the bus. They've got a job someplace. And I've never gone by there and see people totally decrepit on crystal meth or crack or anything. You don't even see people smoking dope there. I'm not saying they're angels. I'm not going down that far. I mean, that group there is not the problem I'm talking about. I mean, if you pull up in a bus and said, everybody hop on, I'm paying you to go clean up a park, everybody hops on. But these other places, I don't think anybody could hop on. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, I think they're that far gone. I just wonder what the time frame is when you get in one of these tent cities before you're not capable of going to work the next day. I mean, I talked to Dr. Blade about it. He thinks it could be as fast as 2-3 weeks if the drugs are piling in and you have none of the right food to eat and everything else. I mean, this will take a massive amount of resources to fix, but I think if you don't spend it, you're worse off. I mean, that's kind of where I'm coming from on this. You could
say...
Well,
you know, it's not ironic to me, Tom, but I'm fascinated by the amount of money being spent in this election. I mean, the Harris campaign has spent or raised $1 billion supposedly, and where is all that money going? And just think of what we could do with that money to help sanctuary cities or, you know, people that are in need. And it's just to me, it's criminal that amount of money can be funneled into a campaign, but it, you know, you can't somehow funnel that into improving society.
Mike, can I, if you don't mind, can I push back here? Because I have the same thoughts about that stuff as you do. Yet I look in the mirror and say, you can't think that way. When I say that, $1 billion to you and me and Jan, maybe not Jan, because I think he's got a little stacked away, is like a real lot of money, isn't it?
At least, yeah, it's a lot of money.
At
right?
least it used to be. Let me ask you this. How many corporations, how many people like a Musk or people like that, or Bezos or Goldman Sachs, how many people would be happy to write that whole check for one side or the other if they could? Because
They do write that check
well, but
for
I'm saying
one
that,
side or the other.
I mean, I think it's hard to understand for people like us, even though we have pretty good education, and I deal with money all day long, and I have some pretty wealthy clients and so forth. The idea that one contract, one favorable thing coming out of government is worth how much to a company now?
And what, oh, it's worth a lot, I'm sure.
What was the COVID fiasco going on now worth to Pfizer in terms of drugs? How many billions of dollars are we talking about? You think they wouldn't write the check?
Well, what was the health care plan worth to Michelle Obama's crony that, you know, got that original contract that couldn't, you know, fulfill it?
I don't think they charged it off because they didn't do it right. But I don't know. I'm saying that was a small-time firm. I don't think they knew enough to charge enough, unfortunately for them. But I'm saying you're right. But what is it? Look at what these people gain out of this. I mean, every time there's a bill written that somebody writes your name in the bill, for God's sake. You know, there wasn't specific companies in congressional bills except for like a small period of time during World War II. Now I guess they're in there all the time, aren't they?
I don't know about in the bills, but, you know, when you get work from the government, it's in there, that's for sure.
But I mean, I'm kind of stunned when you look at a budget that's, you know, how many trillion dollars that people say, God, how is the campaign $1 billion? To the right people, Mike, not like you and me and Jan, I'm not criticizing, the right people, that's chomp change.
Well, they got to pay all those people that are going door to door, or pay all the people that are canvassing and all that. So, it's still old time patronage, no matter how you paint it.
Well, I mean, yes, and it's, I guess that's always going to be sort of politics. But when Richard J., you know, hell, you and I were in school when John was with us, I'd say Chicago under the patronage system worked a hell of a lot better than it's working now.
No, and I agree with you. And it was kind of a, whether it was a small time patronage system or not, you know, I don't know. I never lived in Chicago. And Cleveland probably had its own patronage system. And New York did, because you had Tammany Hall. I mean, I know I'm going back years now, but even so, you know, I guess patronage systems work, but it's if Trump gets into power, there'll be some sort of a patronage system from him, and the Democrats have their own
patronage system.
So,
well, actually, when I was in grad school, I'm sure you remember the name George Stigler, Nobel Prize winner. One day in class, he said, "You know, if I had some time and had a few people that, you know, work for me, little dweebs that do all the work, right? I would love to do a study on two different cities and a patronage system versus the civil service system, and see which one was actually more efficient." He goes, "My gut feel is that the patronage system, if the people in power have some common sense like Richard J. Daley did, is probably better." I mean, I was a beneficiary of that when I was driving a cab or something. My stepfather said, "I'll ask, you know, Uncle Jim if he can get you on with the school board." My stepfather never did anything like that, but my mother must have given him some grief. So Jim calls me up and says, "Go down to see this lady." What the hell is her name? Ann Cranley. And it was in this building, school board building. Go see her. Tell her Marty something something from Ross School sent you. I walk in. I sit down. She got a chair next to her. She had those old metal desks. She's wearing the apron of somebody from the... She's like Aunt B, right? Nothing but stack stuff all over her desk. And so she sits. I sit down and she goes, "Okay, who sent you? Remember the story, we don't want nobody sent?"
Right.
She goes, "Who sent you?" I go, "This guy, Marty something something from the Ross School." "Oh, okay, I got the note right here. You're 21, aren't you?" And I'm like, 17. I go, "Oh, yeah." She goes, "All right, fine. Fill out this application." I fill it out. I go, "Tomorrow, go to the Froebel Upper Grade Center." And I go, "Okay, then." And, you know, but I was the best employee at every place we had. I mean, the thought that I would ever embarrass my uncle by not showing up or anything like that. I mean, you know, it was a janitor job. It was nothing, but I did everything I possibly could. They loved me so much. I was coming back from Notre Dame before Christmas, and I'd call up Ann Cranley, and she goes, "Tom, I don't have a school in a good neighborhood. Ann, we've gone over this before. I don't care where the neighborhood is. I need the job." And she'd send me to some place. She'd do my voice, for God's sake, every break. But I never, the thought of me embarrassing my uncle in that sense, the patronage system worked fine, right? I mean, I guess.
Well, but, and it worked in tandem with civil service back when there was a really, you know, a selection process that required standardized testing and, you know, performance above a certain level. So that in tandem with the patronage system actually made for some pretty good services to the general population. That's all been thrown out the window. So now we don't have merit, and we have a system that's extremely bad.
John, I think there actually was a test for a janitor.
Yeah.
And it was stuff like, you know, if you want to turn a screw this way, which way do you turn a wrench? That kind of stuff.
I'd be appalled if there weren't.
Yeah. You know? I tell you what, it was what an amazing education to characters I met in like the 10 or 15 different schools I was in. I mean, just one of the best lines was I went to the South Shore, which is one of the first air-conditioned schools, and the guy was this big black guy who was the head janitor, nicest guy. Ellie Walker was his name. And we got along pretty good, and I see him on a Monday, and he's all pissed off, and I go, "What's going on?" He goes, "Ah, my son." And I go, "What's the matter?" He goes, "He thinks he's being real slick," being basically an ass. And I go, well, that's kind of what kids do. He goes, I know. He says, but he disappoints me. He's so bad at it. he goes, I was way better at that. Once in a while, I got something by the old man. This kid's dumb as a rack. He can't get anything by me. I'm more disappointed than that, the fact that he's trying. Imagine that. Would you ever say that about one of your kids, Mike?
They screwed up,
but they were such idiots doing it. I'm more worried about that, the fact that they screwed up. Anyway, Mike, thank you. Thank you, John, as usual. And we solved some of the problems in the world. I hope somebody was taking notes. We got a bye this weekend, right?
Yes, we do.
So what are we going to text ourselves all day Saturday?
Who knows? We'll figure out something.
Is there some other game? Is there a chance?
Don't buy Beyonce tickets.
Oh, God.
Yeah, don't buy Beyonce.
Is she that big of a draw? I mean, I guess she is. I don't know.
I'm sure she probably is. Just, you know, they bring Bruce Springsteen out. You know, who knows?
Well, how come? Did you watch the World Series last night? For the 10 minutes before the game, all you do is show the pictures of all the cool guys in the place. Now, would we be in one of those pictures?
Sure, we would.
Tom. Here's Mike Murphy. Here's John Flanagan. And everybody's like, who the hell are those guys? But they had everybody last night. They had Spike Lee. They had Rob Lowe. It was a list of about 20 people they keep shoving pictures at. Now, who gets those guys their seats?
I'm sure the Yankees are having something, or they get their own seats, you know? Yep. Spike Lee seems to have a seat to every major New York sporting event, so.
Well, if you actually are somewhere where your team is in the playoffs, like I was with the Cubs, that was a nice thing about my seats on the upper deck. We were never moved. But if you were in the bottom, I think, 12 rows, you got shoved for the cool guys.
Well, were you able to go to the World Series, Tom? Did you still have your seats?
No,
then?
We had dumped them during the rebuilding process. We couldn't give them away. I mean, if you're a season ticket holder, I mean, you know, I have a real job. If I made it to 20, 25 games, that's really pretty good. I couldn't give the rest away. Matter of fact, one day we called down to the Board of Trade when they still had a bunch of people down there. Go, hey, we got some tickets to the Cubs today. Anybody want them for free? The guy goes, oh, yeah, we want them. I go, what do you mean you want them? He goes, we got a huge stack of them in the middle of the pit. We want to add to the stack. We can't give away. I go, well, that's right. I will keep them up here. But no, it got pretty bad when they were in the. You know what made it even worse, Mike? Is one year they'd start out with a halfway decent team and not do so much. Then they get rid of all their players in like July, whenever they. And so you in August and September, they got no team. You couldn't give those away.
Right, right.
Anyway, guys, thank you. SP Futures down 7, NASDAQ Futures down 42. What we missed here a little bit is the growth came in at 2.8 for the last quarter instead of the 3.1 expected. I'm going to through that tomorrow because I want to look at what the deflator is, because that number doesn't do you any good. Tomorrow we'll go through it because we'll know what the deflator is. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.